Corbin, the work of he and people of the caliber, scholars of the caliber of the late Muhammad Mu'in, did at the old Franco-Iranian Institute on early texts, was impeccable work. It was extremely fine, the best of which France and Iran could be capable in this marvellous field that the French were so adept at, of combining Oriental scholarship with contributions from the countries of the origin of the subjects being studied and French scholarship. This was very good. Later on, when you got more and more institutions established, more help from the Pahlavi Foundation and so on coming, I think one got a lot of really less reliable scholarship manifesting itself. A lot of it rather slick.
So if you wanted to give a view, an overall view, of the last 50 years of the cultural scene, what would it be for you?
Bad.
But why? What about all the achievements?
50 years, I'm terribly bad at mathematics. 50 years takes us back to when? To 1950.
No.
Four.
No. I mean from the... 1930, really, I would like to go back to, or 1925, from the advent of
There was nothing in 1930. Take it from 1941, as I've said earlier on. 1941 to 1951, a very great deal of cultural manifestation. The writings of Hidayat, the writings of Chubak, the writings of Mamani Mahmoud, the writings of a number of people. That was a good period. From 53 onwards, or from 51, the advent of Mossadegh onwards, the scene gradually changes for the worse. And in the last decade, very bad. Great deal of book production, but nothing very truthful or lasting or worthwhile coming out.
What about the all the renaissance of all the crafts, the ancient crafts like pottery, like miniature, like weaving,
it happened, but it was very inorganic insofar as it had no roots in the culture it was representative of. It was artificially induced. It was what I call museum culture. It was pottery, crafts produced in museum conditions, not the real thing. Better that than nothing. But if you're asking me about the cultural health that it demonstrated, my answer is thumbs down. Better than nothing is the best I can say.
You don't think any of the prose work or any of the poetry
survive? Hardly. Survive as a curiosity, survive as a sociological tool to illustrate the expression of a society in transition and in difficulty. Survive for the historian as indicative of the disoriented, uncertain nature of the determination and purposes of a society, but not survive as great art. No.
Wasn't it at least better than the 50 years before?
Well, I don't think it was necessary. I think it was better than anything. No. after all, 50 years before, produced Hedjazi, produced Dashti at their best, who were quite the authors capable of survival, I think.
But they were Pallavira, weren't they? Dashti.
They were.
Mm-hmm. That's it, they were Pallavira.
Yeah.
Dashti and Hedjazi and
all
those people,
they were.
Mm-hmm. So one can't say that the Dilan is totally negative, then, what?
No, but I wasn't talking in terms of Pahlavi, I was talking in terms of periods. You said this last period.
Well, no, what I mean is the Pahlavi period. We're talking about the Pahlavi period.
Oh, the whole Pahlavi period. No, I don't think you can... I can't dismiss the whole Pahlavi period. As I said, between 1941 and 1951 was a great period of production of arts, and that was Pahlavi period too. Yeah.
Well, that's what we are assessing, the whole of the, from the advent of the Pahlavis.
From 1925.
That's right, that's what I said.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Well, fair enough. Not very good on the whole, but it did produce Sadiq Hidayat, it produced Jubak, it produced some great art, Dashti, Hijazi and others. On the whole, it's not a very great period. It was a period of great cultural uncertainty.
But was the decline, the cultural decline, due to the
period of great cultural uncertainty, as I think the recent revolution has shown? Now, your question.
The question is that if is it because of what Jalal al-Ahmad called Gharb Zadegi, was the cultural shock with the onrush of Western influences and Western languages and so forth, or is it really, in some ways, a universal phenomenon? Insofar as, of course, I believe, I may be wrong, that in the West even, although there is a tremendous amount of activity and production, there is very little of great importance and comparable to the best of the past has appeared even in the West since the Second World War.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. This is entirely outside the scope, incidentally, of what I understood this recording to be about, which was my reminiscences of my experiences in
Iran.
That's right, but I think you're absolutely right. I think the whole of the modern era in the West and in any cultures which are Western-oriented, Western-associated, which modern Iranian culture certainly was until the revolution, I think there's a terrible decline in standards and a terrible new ignorance, new gibberish, and lowering and degradation and deterioration of the standards and understanding. In a sense, you can say that Iran was suffering from the malaise of the culture that it was that it become too closely associated
with. That's exactly
with.
What I was trying to
yes,
point
I think
out.
You're quite right there.
That maybe that is what was part
yes,
of the reason.
This is one of the reasons why Jalal al-Ahmad, an old friend of mine, incidentally, spent a day with me and a night once here in Cambridge, literally a day and a night, for we never went to bed. We talked the whole day and we talked the whole night. We walked about Cambridge in the night, looking at the stars, and going on with our conversation. He's a remarkable man. He wrote this book called Westernitis, I suppose you could translate this, Gharb Zadegi, this strange title. It was banned, of course, for a long time. His book was under the Pahlavis. It's not a good book, incidentally. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm not pretending, I'm not claiming that it was a work of great genius. In many ways, it was an extremely wrong-headed and imprecise and ill-informed book, if you don't mind my saying so. I mean, I do know young Europeans and young Iranians, great believers in Jalal al-Ahmad, who would be very angry, kill me for saying that. But I have to say it because I'm quite honest where literary matters are concerned, and rather severe. But he wrote this book, but he wouldn't have written this book, perhaps, had not Western arts themselves been in a state of deterioration and uncertainty, which he probably didn't appreciate. But his own country's culture was in a state of grave uncertainty, and he wanted to blame it on somebody, so he blamed it on Westernitis, somewhat wrongly, I think. But then Iranians never blame their fault on themselves if they can help it. Try to find somebody else to be the scapegoat. Yeah.
What about another subject I wanted to ask you about was the Freemasonry.
Yes.
You know that there was this big, you know, with their usual thing of exaggeration, talent for exaggeration. Iranians think that Freemasonry is very important in Iran and...
yeah. Well, Freemasonry, I don't think, is very important in Iran. Iran is a country of dorés, of circles, of coteries, groups, one of which liked to call itself Freemasonry. I don't think it was ever really recognized by any of the international Freemasonry lodges, the Scottish, the English, or the French.
It wasn't?
Speaking. No, not really properly. And I don't think they were really serious as Freemasons, but it was another form of coterie and brotherhood. In any kind of society that is socially and politically insecure, you get a tendency to try and form coteries of men, like-minded men, men of similar principles and aims and aspirations, who like to join together and perhaps bind themselves, if the society is insecure, with oaths of secrecy and that kind of thing, so they can feel that they're free in at least one place at one time to have open and frank discussion, especially where people are sophisticated and intelligent, as the sort of Iranians who would join such a coterie would be. But I saw just a little of Iranian Freemasonry. Not that I'm a Freemason, I'm certainly not. I think I was brought up in Britain very much by a grandfather and a father who very much abhorred and deplored Freemasonry, simply because, not because they disliked Freemasonry in particular, but because they objected to any form of secret society. They considered such a form extremely dangerous to society. So that I was not a Freemason. But I think that I understood why certain Iranians wanted to unite themselves in this particular way.
Why would they want to do that? I said why they would want to do it,
because they were in a socially and politically insecure society.
That's right, for security purposes, you mean?
Of course, for purposes of being feeling free to be frank and united in some kind of a small coterie of brothers and friends.
And mutual support.
Mutual support. Very important element in it, the mutual support. Yeah.
But you don't think that they were that powerful in Iran, or were they in any way?
The components of a Freemasonry society in Iran, the individual components, were men to whom influence and power would be ascribed. People like Manoocher Iqbal, who was one such, and the Intizams and other such, Hussein Allah and so on, all sorts of people whom influence and power were ascribed. But I don't think that this was due to their being in a Freemasonry society. It was due entirely to their individual character and position in society. Freemasonry as such, I think, was totally powerless, of no importance whatsoever, and a charade.
It was a charade, wasn't it? It wasn't connected with the British Freemasonry.
And I'm afraid it was not. It always wished it were, but it was not.
I wonder why, on what account the British Freemasonry sort of rejected the...
I think Freemasonry is, of its nature, pretty insular, if not provincial. It's a very much local town phenomenon, rather like the Lions or the Rotarians. There's nothing... The international aspect of Freemasonry is, I think, very, very underdeveloped. Also, of course, European Freemasonry is pretty careful about its affiliations. British Freemasonry would rush to be affiliated with
Prussian.
Prussians.
Can you remember any other personalities, events, stories that seemed significant to you at the time or reflected on the society and on events?
One of the things that's always astonished me is how slow the West was to realize that there was going to be a revolution in Iran and that that revolution was going to be total. And I do wonder why it is that Iranians and others should think, for example, that Western intelligence services are so good, when obviously they had no idea of what was happening.
Did you not have any connection with the
embassy?
No,
none at all. Never. I had social connections with embassy people, as you well know, since you and I share friends who at various times have been in the British Embassy, but I had no official connection whatsoever. In fact, the embassies generally suspected me, rather than using me, they generally suspected me of being anti-British and rather too pro the society in which I was living. I was always rather inclined to be a little bit of a maverick, so far as the establishment of my own country was concerned, and still am, and hope to remain so. so that I always deeply resent Iranian and American suspicions of my being a spy on behalf of governments. I deeply resent it because it's totally untrue, and rather ironical if one's suspected by one's own government of being too far the other way. It's rather ironical that the other side should suspect one of being too far towards the way of espionage and so on. Anyway, it's not very important.
No,
I just
keep
you the same.
Yes, sure.
Anecdotes. The one anecdote that I will conclude with is castigatory itself. It's at expense of myself. When I was in Iran in September 1975, the Asadullah Alam, as Minister of Court, asked me to write a book on the Shah and People's Revolution. That's what it was to be called. And I said I couldn't write such a book, because I would have to say things about the regime which the regime would not like. And Asadullah Alam said, write it as if you were writing to me, and just be yourself. You could write perfectly honestly. I said, well, I'll do that in any case. Well, he said, just write it. He said, the way you will write it won't be offensive. You will write the truth, but you will write it in a gentlemanly and inoffensive way that even he will accept. And I went back to the old gentleman in whose house I was staying, Sayyid Sadiq Goharin, and I said, they want me to write a book. And to my surprise, expecting my old mentor, my old teacher, and brother, and friend, and father figure, to say, oh, you wouldn't do anything like that, leave it, Baelish Kun, Ara, Baelish Kun, Kara Shaman East. He didn't say any of those things that I expected him to say. He said, how much did they offer you? Well, I said, as a matter of fact, they offered me in great secrecy quite a lot. And as I'm a very poor man, they presumably were playing on their knowledge of my impecuniosity. He said, how much? I said, they offered me £6,000. He said, not enough. He said, the American, the French, and other British journalists, and Mustache Ragin and all the rest of them, they've all had their cut. They've all taken their share out of the loot that this Dowlat, this regime, is distributing. It is now your turn, because you, more than any of them, to Zehnimar, Rafta Eid. Shema Bishtas Hamishon, Mara Mifahmid, Kamishna Seed. No Batish Yomast. Shema Chisitono Begiri, Juniman. No Batish Yomast. Dahazar Liri Bishbegi, Shema Badbash. Shema Badbash. Sakhme Shema Badbash. Your share must be at least 10,000. I was amazed at this. because it was totally contrary to what I expected him to say. And I said, and about the book? I can't write the book, though, I said. Oh, he said, never mind about the book. Tomu ge kishama unkitabra benevisid hich kudam azin ha. Hich kudam azin ha. Said Hich kudam azin ha nacha ad bud. Till you've, by the time you've written this book, not one of these people will be here. And I took no notice. I saw the British ambassador that same afternoon. I never mentioned it to him. I wrote to him when the revolution occurred, and I said, I owe you an apology. His name was Sir Anthony Parsons. I said, dear Tony, I owe an apology. And I told him the whole story, and I said, I saw you the same day, and I never told you that the wise old Iranian had told me that in, say, 2-3 years' time, not a single one of the people in power at that time would exist.
Why did
it? And I said, because it never occurred to me that it was of any importance or any significance. I thought it was the remark of a silly, frustrated old man. But I said, I apologize now, because I said I was being warned of what was to happen, and I took no notice of it. I should have told you, though, perhaps. I should have repeated at least the warning. And he wrote back to me and he said, don't worry, Peter, kind of you to write, but I would have been just the same as you. I would have taken no notice either. Both of us then would have been warned, and neither of us would have taken any notice. As it happens, only you received that warning, and you took no notice. I took no notice of what my old friend said, and when the revolution occurred, my old friend wrote to me. And in his letter he said, I well remember one morning when you returned from your visit to the Minister of Court, sitting in my gulkhane with me, and I said to you, by the time you write that book, which you never did write, not one of them would be there. And you looked at me, Misli Sahif Pishi Argil, like, Misli P. Argil Pishi Sahif, you looked at me like an intelligent man in front of a fool. And I wrote back and I said, I remember the morning perfectly well. Your account is only inaccurate in one respect. I didn't look at you like an intelligent man looking at a fool. But I didn't take any notice of what you said. I was warned in that way and in other ways too, which I won't get into, but that's the last anecdote. You asked for an anecdote. That's my anecdote. I was warned in several ways in 1975. Again in 1977, of the onset of the revolution of 1979, and I did not take any notice of the signs which friends of mine spread before me.
Did they know it was the mullahs that were going to do it?
I don't know what they knew, but they were trying to tell me that somebody was going to do something. Hich kudam azun ha nacha hefu. Each Khodam Azin Ha Nacha had put Tom O'Bey Kishima.
That was a terrible story, really.
Well, somebody, a lot of people must have known the amount of money that was taken out of the country by people who will swear that they didn't know. You say to me, as you say, oh, well, they bought Pied d'Auteur in London because they used to come there shopping. Pied d'Auteur, people I know who bought apartments in Chalfont House in Belgrave, yeah.
No, I was
some
thinking
Pied
of
d'Auteur.
I was thinking of the ones who had a little studio somewhere in Paris.
I wasn't thinking of the studios. I was thinking of the houses, whole houses and apartments now worth hundreds of thousands of pounds. Our own Parviz Raji. Look at the house. The first thing I did, he said, when I became ambassador to London, was to buy this house, the wisest and cleverest thing I've ever done in my life. Look at the house. old Queen Anne house in Holland Park Avenue. The old road is not a bad going.
It's terribly sad for the whole.
Well, it was prudent. Not sad for people who did it and had the money to do it with.
It was sad for the country.
But what I'm talking about is that it's so strange that so many people pretended they didn't know. And it's quite clear to me that a lot did.
Why didn't they do something about it?
Didn't want to be shown as rats deserting the sinking ship, perhaps.
What do you think posterity will think of the whole of the Pahlavi era?
Posterity? Not much.
You see, I find it very hard to accept that, because as a woman who was emancipated because of the... I mean, somebody like me with my background would have got married, stayed in each other and stayed there totally, I feel that...
Oh no, I think there's quite a lot of good to be said for the Pahlavi era, and I hope posterity will be kind to it, but posterity may not be. Oh, it is good to be said for the Pahlavi era, and it should be said, but there's also a lot of bad to be said for it, I'm afraid.
Yes, but you know, it's like the French left-wingers, they used to say, when you used to tell them, what about Stalin, what of Gulag, what about things, and they would say, well, you know, le bilan est positif. I never believed that, of course, because it isn't. Le bilan of the Soviet regime is not positive. It's almost 100% negative. But I feel that maybe the bilan of the Pahlavi is in some way positive, if only because they liberated half of their human resources there. I mean, all the women doctors, all the women nurses, all the women advocates, teachers, I mean, all the things that they did. I mean, if you take only that one measure, it seems to me that redeems a lot. Maybe because I'm a woman, I think that. But what do you think would the bilan be, positive or negative, the whole thing, vie d'ensemble?
Remind me what the word bilan means.
Sum total.
Sum total, that's what I thought it meant. Difficult to say. I'm assessing the history of periods of human activity. I don't myself think in terms of bilan. I think in terms of cruelty, oppression, arrogance, greed, corruption. In those terms, I think the bilan, the Pahlavi regime, would be extremely negative. And certainly its aftermath.
After?
Its aftermath is appallingly negative in that respect. No, I don't see much good in history, but I'm a generation that has lived through the massacre of 6 million Jews. I've lived through episodes worse than anything Genghis Khan has ever attributed to him. So if we're talking about the bilans of history, I can see covering the last 50 years, the last 60 years, no very positive bilan.
Anywhere.
Yes.
Any other personalities you would like to mention?
The courtesy of Engineer Hidayat, Khosrow Hidayat, the beautiful manners and courtesy of so many Iranian gentlemen whose names are now vilified, I have known. The old aristocrats, the courtesy of Sadiq Hidayat, who was always an aristocrat, he was always a gentleman. I remember one night I was too drunk in his company to be allowed to go back to where I was staying, and had to be put up for the night by an Iranian friend, a member of the circle, man called Hassane Pakravan, not the same Pakravan we alluded to earlier on, another Pakravan. And I remember I was drunk, lying on the ground, but I was not so drunk that I didn't hear Hidayat giving minute instructions as to how the bed should be made in the European style for him, because he's European, you know, and how he should be given 2 boiled eggs and toast and preserve for breakfast, because that's the sort of breakfast they have in England, you know, and going on in such meticulous detail, this perfect gentleman, who was always far more concerned for the welfare and the comfort of other people than for himself, and concerned for the other people's welfare and comfort with the imagination of an artist who wanted the foreigner and the Englishman to wake up the next morning in a bed of the type he was accustomed to a breakfast of the kind he was used to. That was Iranian courtesy, but it was the courtesy of an old-fashioned Iranian gentleman of très de bonne famille, the Hidayats.
Voilà, thank you very much. I think we've reached the end of our of this particular tape, which is number 5. Voilà. Finished, really.